produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today. U.S. Supreme Court refuses to hear Florida's dog on the doorstep case. The United States Supreme Court has refused to consider whether a narcotics dog sniffing at the front door of a residence constitutes an illegal search. Lawyers for a Florida man were able to successfully suppress drug evidence against him because police officers had obtained a search warrant based on a dog sniffing at the defendant's front door. Florida's attorney general argued that bringing a police dog to a citizen's doorstep did not intrude on one's reasonable expectation of privacy. Florida's appeals court disagreed, reaffirming the decision to suppress the evidence. Because of its obvious odor, marijuana is arguably the easiest to detect of all prohibited substances. The scent of marijuana on a person, in their home, or in their vehicle is one of the most common probable cause reasons given for further search or issuance of a search warrant by law enforcement. However, empirical data published in the journal Law and Human Behavior in 2004 brought this practice into question. Quote, although law enforcement officials routinely rely solely on the sense of smell to justify probable cause when entering vehicles and dwellings to search for illicit drugs, the accuracy of their perception in this regard has rarely been questioned, close quote, said authors at the Smell and Taste Center at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. The researchers evaluated data from two empirical studies based upon actual legal cases in which police relied on the odor of marijuana as probable cause for the search. In the first, they simulated a situation in which during a routine traffic stop, the odor of packaged marijuana located in the trunk of an automobile was said to be detected through the driver's window. In the second, researchers investigated a report that marijuana's odor was discernible from a considerable distance from the chimney effluents of diesel exhaust emanating from an illicit grow room. Six of the nine participants in the first trial were unable to detect the odor of marijuana. In the second trial, none of the participants could reliably detect the marijuana odor embedded in diesel fumes. Quote, our findings suggest that the odor of marijuana was not reliably discernible by persons with an excellent sense of smell in either case, close quote, the trial's authors concluded. Even with such data, law enforcement officers are rarely challenged on their own scent detection. Yet other cases involving dogs or devices have come under intense constitutional scrutiny. In 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a dog sniffing at a vehicle during a routine traffic stop did not violate the Fourth Amendment. But in 2001, the U.S. Supreme Court found that the use of thermal imaging equipment to detect a marijuana growing operation in a garage did constitute an illegal search. In Alaska, possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana is allowable in the home for personal consumption. Alaska's privacy protections are the most robust in the nation. Attempts to criminalize marijuana possession in Alaska have all been unsuccessful because the state constitution there protects citizens from such government intrusion. Music. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org. And don't forget to do some Normal holiday shopping. We have links to new Normal products for the holiday season right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. And check out the new program of affiliate links. That's right, put up links on your MySpace page, your Facebook page, or your website, and you can actually make a little money this holiday season promoting marijuana law reform. Check us out on the Cafe Press affiliates page. We have links at normalaudiostash.com. Our political landscape in America changed dramatically with the November 7th midterm elections, especially with scrutiny of the Iraq War. News online, in print, on TV, and radio is now dominated by questions about the Iraq conflict, its status, reasons surrounding it, and most notably the overwhelming cost in lives and dollars. American voters are now asking hard questions about contractors and military involvement because there has been such stagnation in the violent conflict. Yet the cost and effort in human hours, indeed even the violence, pales in comparison to the failure of the so-called drug war right here at home. This week, major news organizations began calling the Iraq conflict a civil war. But is mainstream media ignoring a civil war right here on American soil? This modern so-called war on drugs has seen an intense expenditure of tax dollars and resources that essentially pit law enforcement agencies against American citizens. Data out this week regarding America's staggering increase in prison population shows that over 7 million Americans are in prison, on probation, or on parole. From 1995 to 2003, inmates in federal prison for drug offenses have accounted for 49% of total prison population growth. This means that our failed war on drugs is the biggest reason for the increases. Racial disparities in enforcement are also striking. In the 25 to 29 age group, 8.1% of black men, about 1 in 13, are incarcerated. This data comes from the Justice Department's Bureau of Justice Statistics. So if we're so quick to question the Iraq conflict policy and practice because of the expense and obvious lack of success, why isn't there more scrutiny of this so-called war on drugs? The answer is that many people are now asking the simple questions of cost-benefit when it comes to drug prohibition. Joining us today is Nolan Finley, an independent newspaper columnist and the editorial editor at the Detroit News. Nolan, welcome to Normal's podcast today.
Good to be with you all.
Great to speak with you, Nolan. Thanks again for joining us. I read your recent column entitled "Subject the Drug War to the Iraq War Test." Nolan, how did you come to this conclusion that we should offer the same scrutiny happening in Washington around Iraq to our prohibition enforcement policy?
Consistent with me for the last few years, and I should point out that this was a column, this wasn't an editorial, this is not the newspaper's position, this was in my personal column, which I write once a week. So this is not the newspaper's position, but my own were measured by the same standards the war in Iraq is being measured, we would have the same outcome. People would be calling for a withdrawal, a redeployment, an end to the damn thing.
You cited something in this column, Nolan, that really stood out. About half of all wiretaps are approved for drug-related cases. And as you say here in the column, that the law has been rewritten to allow their okay even on the scantest of evidence.
Well, we know that's true. And I think, forgive me, I don't have all my research in front of me, but I believe that was off a Rand Corp study. But we know that the law has been, in many ways, not just for wiretaps, has been, and civil liberties have been stretched very thin in the name of this drug war. If you think about the civil liberties we've given up, the latest one being that police no longer have to fully announce themselves before barging in your door, on and on and on, forfeiture laws that destroy the whole concept of innocent until you're proven guilty, and property rights, where if you're arrested for a crime, doesn't matter if you're convicted or not, the mere fact that you've been arrested in many jurisdictions means that police can keep your property and sell it and keep the money. And so our civil liberties, and if you'll notice, one of the things that was curious to me when the terrorist legislation was, anti-terrorism legislation, the Patriot Act was being rewritten or written, they stretched it to also include drug offenses, as if the war on drugs is an equal threat to our society as the war on terrorism. I found that very, very telling that we categorize them at equal levels in writing the Patriot Act and other legislation.
So, Nolan, have we taken what are really bad practices and cues from the so-called war on drugs and incorporated them into our current national security fluster?
I think what the drug war did was numb people to the idea of giving up their civil liberties in the name of a greater good. It started in earnest with the drug war. Yes, let's give up some of our privacy protections because we can fight drugs, and drugs are a bad thing. And that's the same thing you're hearing in the war on terror. Let's give up some of our privacy, some of our equal protection rights, so that we can fight this evil thing. But the problem is, we fight, we never seem to win anything.
Nolan, you also touch on the racial aspects of prohibition enforcement. Is that something particularly clear in the city of Detroit?
Well, of course. I mean, our city's been decimated by the drug war. I mean, and our prison system are full of people convicted of drug offenses. And my position is that if you take the crime out of it, if you take the profit out of the crime, many of these people wouldn't be in jail. They would be forced to seek other means of supporting themselves. And you know, we have allowed the criminals and criminal enterprises to control the distribution of narcotics, and so what you have is a lot more crime coming out of that distribution.
You talk about accountability, and do you think that the attitude in America has shifted enough right now that regular Americans will begin to demand that accountability in the so-called war on drugs?
Not on the drug war. I think that we are just culturally institutionalized to think this is something we have to do, and this, we're doing this in the name of the greater good, and it doesn't matter if we can't post any results or not. You can't get an audience for saying, let's give it up, let's quit this, you know, let's find another avenue. You know, I suggest in this column, treatment would be a better use of the money, the $50 billion we're spending on the drug war. The bulk of that should go to treatment, but I also think that since 40% of the resources go into combating marijuana and marijuana use, that perhaps we just give that all up altogether. Sell marijuana alongside Jim Beam and Grey Goose vodka in the liquor stores and be done with it, because there's a hypocrisy here in that marijuana is no more harmful and perhaps a lot less so than alcohol and alcohol abuse, and yet we treat marijuana the same way we treat heroin.
We've also seen a heavy semantic battle go on in the last few years, and this whole concept, if you're not with us, you're against us. Did that come from this so-called war on drugs as well, painting the attitudes of our fellow Americans with such broad strokes?
Only in this sense. There's no room to criticize the drug war. You can criticize perhaps the execution of it, the tactics in some cases, but there's no room to criticize the overall legitimacy of spending this sort of money and resources to keep people from doing the things they want to do.
We're speaking with Nolan Finley, the editorial editor at the Detroit News, about his new independent column, Subject the Drug War to the Iraq War Test. It's available online. Nolan, I want to thank you again for joining us here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Also Today, an editorial from your host and humble narrator, Chris Goldstein. In the last few weeks, recent media highlighted home delivery of marijuana in New York City, and thus classist prohibition enforcement. The Associated Press has profiled a growing trend in New York marijuana culture, home delivery. The story's been picked up nationally and published in dozens of newspapers. Last year, the Drug Enforcement Administration conducted a sting operation against the Cartoon Network, a marijuana delivery service run by John Neble. The service served mainly professional executives and other upper-middle-class and wealthy clientele. The model was simple. Customers placed their order via phone or the internet. A delivery person arrived with high-grade marijuana in special packaging and collected the preset fee. It's as easy as ordering pizza or Chinese food. While Neble's service was certainly not a monopoly, it does highlight the racial and class differences in marijuana consumption, and thus the risks for arrest. At the 2006 Normal Conference in San Francisco, Judge William Murphy Jr. from Baltimore gave a compelling talk about race and the drug war, in which he highlighted the major differences in how black urban residents purchase their marijuana compared to white suburban residents. Judge Murphy pointed out that many suburban consumers have their marijuana delivered to their homes, pooling their money to purchase larger quantities at fewer intervals, while black urban residents often purchase much smaller quantities more frequently in the street atmosphere. This puts those urban marijuana consumers at more risk for arrest and personal harm. The Associated Press took great pains in their coverage to interview a delivery person for the marijuana service in New York, as well as former customers of Neble's Cartoon Network, all of whom expressed the fact that the marijuana delivery service was more expensive than conventional distributors, but that the price was worth the convenience, the lower personal risk, and consistent quality. The Associated Press also pointed out that many of Neble's former clients were lawyers, doctors, Wall Street professionals, and those in the entertainment industry, even celebrities, but no names were mentioned by the DEA. Neble's computer records were seized, including the names of delivery couriers and a complete customer database. Yet New York City's special narcotics prosecutor, Bridget Brennan, conceded that those involved with the Cartoon Network faced little risk of future prosecution. Not so for the average black urban resident, who is caught with even a small amount of marijuana on the street. Sting operations in urban areas specifically targeting those who seek to purchase less than 7 grams of marijuana are so common that Americans can watch them documented on several episodes of the popular TV series Cops. Marijuana consumption exists in all race and classes in America. It's perhaps the most common shared experience in this country, beyond attending school and getting a driver's license. Prohibition has negative impacts on all levels of our society, but the brunt of enforcement hits people of color, who live in cities, the worst. Is it such a surprise that wealthy, mainly white individuals smoke marijuana? No. But it should be a wake-up call to all Americans that last year over 700,000 U.S. citizens were arrested on marijuana violations, 90% of which were for simple possession, and a disproportionate number of those arrestees are people of color. The so-called drug war in the United States, focused really on marijuana, is a war on Americans of color. The continuation of the status quo in marijuana prohibition is perhaps the last fully institutionalized racism funded by our tax dollars. Racist and classist marijuana prohibition enforcement could be seen in history as the biggest factor in holding back the progress of urban America. Yet the Associated Press and other media continue to grant top coverage to the methamphetamine epidemic, a terrible scourge to be sure, but a problem that centers in white, rural communities. John Neble faces up to 10 years in prison and forfeiture of over $22 million in cash and assets for running the Cartoon Network. Yet this pales in comparison to the trillions of dollars lost in economic activity, urban development, and diminishment of the workforce, with 1 in 20 African-American males behind bars or on probation, mainly for drug prohibition-related offenses. After a recent internet search failed to turn up any Associated Press reporter arrested for a marijuana-related offense, one can only assume that the Associated Press only employs stone-cold sober individuals or that they are simply getting door-to-door marijuana delivery. We've received a lot of email lately asking questions about cancer. So today we're going to revisit our interview with Paul Armentano on just that subject. Paul's the author of The Normal Report, Cannabis Smoke and Cancer, Assessing the Risk. It's on Normal's website and we have links to it at normalaudiostash.com. Paul, first of all, tell us what drew you to compile this report, Cannabis Smoke and Cancer, Assessing the Risk.
Well, as people familiar with this show or familiar with the Normal organization will know, we represent the cannabis consumers, and the question of health risks to those consumers by the consumption of marijuana smoke is a question that comes up time and time again, and with good reason. Our constituency is concerned that there could be potential harm by the intake of carcinogenic smoke in the case of marijuana. So we felt, because the federal government does not see fit to put out objective reporting and science on this issue, we felt for the sake of our constituency that we would conduct a review of the scientific literature on this subject and present to the reader and to the consumer an objective evaluations of the potential risks of consuming cannabis smoke.
Cigarette smoke, of course, is filled with a number of known cancer-causing agents. We know cigarette smoke causes cancer, especially if you chronically inhale it over time. But does cannabis smoke...
One of the interesting things that I found putting together this report was the fact that this issue really hasn't been scientifically studied to the extent that the links between not just tobacco use and cancer, but also alcohol use and cancer. There's quite a strong causal link there. But in fact, that same type of causal link has not been found in populations, particularly that use marijuana only, but even in populations that use marijuana and tobacco smoke. Now, that is not to say that at some point down the road we may actually find such an association. But as of this point, of the large-scale population studies that have been done, such a link has not been found. The closest that there has been to finding such a link has been a pair of studies, both of which I believe were published in the late 1990s, that did find some cellular abnormalities in marijuana smoking individuals, and these were cellular changes that are often consistent with precancerous cells that we see in cases of tobacco smoking. So that is not I don't want to imply that the studies give marijuana smokers a clean bill of health here, but unlike the large body of evidence and data that we have now showing alcohol and tobacco use being causal factors in certain cancers, we do not have that same kind of data for marijuana smoke.
Paul, tell us a little bit about the science of this report. What kind of science and data did you use to compile cannabis smoke and cancer?
Actually, there is a major study going on. It's actually been completed. It's awaiting publication. That was funded by the National Institutes of Health. It was looking at 2,400 individuals in Los Angeles, and it was assessing their risk of contracting cancers of the upper aerodigestive tract in individuals who use marijuana versus non-users. I am familiar with the preliminary data from that, which actually did not find an association between marijuana use and people contracting these types of cancers. And in fact, I believe there's some data pointing to an inverse association in which individuals who use marijuana use seem to have a lower risk of contracting these cancers than the controls that they looked at in the study. So it will be very interesting if and when that study does get published to examine it. But there have been in the past about 4 or 5 years, two or three interesting studies looking at this subject. There were two studies looking at the possibility that younger individuals could be contracting cancers of the head, neck, and throat, and lungs if they were using marijuana. There'd been claims for some time that, in fact, physicians were seeing younger and younger patients not known to be contracting those types of cancers coming in with those sort of cancers and also saying they used marijuana. In fact, there were two large population-controlled studies done looking at that in 2005. Neither one of them found any sort of association between early marijuana use and early onset of those types of cancers. There was also a major population study done by Kaiser Permanente involving over 65,000 individuals that was performed in the late 1990s that looked at marijuana use and its potential association with many tobacco use-related cancers and other cancers as well, such as prostate cancer, skin cancer, breast cancer. And there again, in that population study, the investigators found no association between the use of marijuana and contracting these types of cancers. In fact, I do believe that among marijuana-only smokers, they did not have anyone in that cohort who actually had a diagnosis of lung cancer.
And how does tobacco smoke directly compare to cannabis smoke?
Known carcinogens in tobacco smoke, and some of those same carcinogens are known to be in marijuana smoke. Not necessarily in the same quantities, but they are known to be there. There are, however, some serious differences between the two. One specifically is the fact that, as everyone knows, tobacco smoke contains nicotine, and nicotine is known to proliferate the formation of cancer. Cannabis smoke contains cannabinoids, such as THC, but there are others. THC is actually not known, nor is any other cannabinoid, known to proliferate the formation of cancer cells. And in fact, in both animal studies and also in culture, cannabinoids have been shown to have anti-cancer properties. So clearly that is a fundamental difference between the two. You have one that has a known cancer-causing agent, and you have the other that has known anti-cancer-causing agents. Of course, it's also important to point out that individuals can avoid the risk of taking in carcinogenic smoke completely if they engage in a process known as vaporization. And that is a process whereby individuals heat the psychoactive constituents in marijuana, such as THC, and then inhale the vapor, but they do not heat up to the point of burning the surrounding matter, and that is the matter which contains most of the carcinogens in cannabis smoke.
Well, thanks again, Paul, for your time here today, and where can our listeners find out some more information?
No problem, Chris, and I would advise people who would like to read this report to go online to www.norml.org, and also they can find with that report embedded links to virtually all of the scientific literature looking at this issue. They can click on those and they can read the original studies for themselves, and I would encourage people to do so.
Thanks again, Paul, for this great report, Cannabis Smoke and Cancer, Assessing the Risk.
Sure, no problem, Chris.
Paul Armentano is Normal's Senior Policy Analyst. You can read the report at normal.org. This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. thanks to Podshow.com for all the great PodSafe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.